Hey, everybody. Welcome. Going to start here in just a few minutes, so if everyone can try and find a seat, come on in. Welcome to the Achieving Great Safety and Sustainability on a Shoestring Budget. My name's Jack Dyer. I'm the founder of Topa Topa Brewing Company, based in Ventura, California. We have five tap rooms. I'm also a proud serving member on the taproom committee here for the BA. Before we get started and dive into the session, I just want to make a few notes. We're not too filled up here. So lots of plenty of seats, so you should be good there. But make sure to silence your cell phones here. I think we're all in pretty good practice of that at these things. But make sure that happens. Obviously, due to the COVID measures, please make sure to keep your masks covering your nose and mouth for the entirety of the session until you get outside. We're going to be taking questions during the session in a little bit of a different way using Slido. It should be up here. You can scan that QR code and link, and make sure you pick the room to ask your questions in here, and the guys will get to as many as they can. If we can't get to all of them, they will we'll answer them after, and they'll be posted along with the presentation. So thank you guys for that. Finally, at the end of the seminar, please make sure to submit the seminar feedback survey. This is a short two-question survey associated with each seminar that you attend. It's held within the CBC mobile application. This really does help the Brewers Association staff and committee members help us plan and get better for next year to serve you guys. So we appreciate you all being here. I'll briefly introduce the speakers that we have here. We have the Dueling Mats here today. We have Matt Gaciocz, Sustainability Ambassador for the Brewers Association, and Matt Stinchfield, Safety Ambassador for the Brewers Association. Really cool topics that they're going to cover for you guys today, so thanks for being in attendance, and I'll turn it over to them. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Jack. And welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming out this morning. We'll keep it light, and we'll make a couple of bad jokes, and we'll give you some good take-home information. So what more could you ask for? So it was interesting when we realized that safety and sustainability had so many commonalities, and you're going to see some of those today. Here's essentially what we're going to talk about. First, that the commonality is based around an effective culture. And culture can apply to anything. Your business already has a culture, but I'm going to point out some very significant opportunities that you have by using existing elements of your culture, fine-tuning those, and then sort of cross-tying them in a maybe more of a neural network way than a linear way. We'll look at the current paradigm for how we effectuate safety and sustainability in our workplaces. You know, what's our current model for doing that? And we have actually numerical data to show that that's not really very effective. Some of you may already intuitively know that. And then we'll talk about a different paradigm of a more networked culture model, and we'll give you the numerical facts behind that and make the case that this is the way we should be going. And then we're going to really give you a lot of information on specific safety and sustainability opportunities that you have by way of checklists that you can download after the fact and literally put right into use. So with that, let's get cracking. This is our current model, and it's linear, and it's based on the idea that we have an individual or some individuals in the company that have knowledge. And we'll put those people in the box that says compliance knowledge. These are people who know a lot about safety or a lot about sustainability. They're your in-house experts, go-to people. And combined with their knowledge of the specific details of the technologies and processes that come with safety and sustainability, right? We have knowledgeable people who have information. They know where to get answers, and they know how to do things, and that we put those two together, and we get a desired outcome. And that desired outcome is, say, a safe workplace or a sustainability program that yields good benefits, present and future. You know, this is pretty much how we do things, right? Would you all agree? Right? We're not all sustainability experts, are we? We have resources for that. One of the problems with this approach is being key person based is it leaves the business vulnerable. It also causes some workplace drama that can involve selective advancement. Only those people who know something get to know more. And it results in certain kinds of gamesmanship where people are very protective of their slot in the company organizational structure. It's not very inclusive, and by inclusive I mean we're not getting inputs to our sustainability and safety questions from every part of the company. And sometimes the best solutions come from the most unexpected places. And it's not resilient to personnel changes. I'll give you just a simple example. A brewery has a brewmaster who knows the recipes, who knows the brew house processes for producing wort. And they're the only employee in your company that has that knowledge. And they take a vacation, or they get fired, or they move on to another job. Now the business is suffering. It has to catch up. So it's not very resilient to personnel changes. And what we're going to propose to you resolves a lot of these difficulties that come with the current model. But first, let me give you some numerical basis to come along with us. You may know of linear coefficient of correlation we call R squared. And basically what this is a numerical means for us to say there is a relationship between quantity A and quantity B. So for example, let's say it rains. And when it rains, the sewers fill. And when it rains, people get wet. And so we want to explore the question of, when the sewers fill, do people get wet? And so we look at, okay, we rate how full the sewers are, and we count how many people are wet. And we see that there's some kind of a correlation between the two. We don't know that the reason it is because of more rain. We don't even care. But we notice that there's a relationship. When people are wet, the sewers are full. And it doesn't have to be both going up. It could be when the sewers are full, people are dry. What is the relationship? Well, it's a linear relationship. They are correlated. It's just that when one goes up, the other goes down. And when both come up, or one comes up and the other goes down, and there's a good sound relationship there, the R squared value approaches 1, the number 1. And when there's a vague or no relationship there, the R squared value approaches 0. So by looking at this R squared number, we can see, is there a correlation between these two quantities? The first quantity we're looking at is, does our knowledgeable individual relate to good performance in a safety or sustainability initiative? And the result is 0.13, not very good. In fact, not really anything to talk about. And if we look at the relationship between the technical resources and the desired outcome of a good program, we find that there's no significance whatever. We completely cannot say when one happens, the other benefits or loses. And when we compare comparison between the knowledge of individuals and the technical resources they have, we see a vague association. So if our current operative model is we have a few people who know a lot, and they know what resources are needed by way of equipment and activities that we undertake, that we will have a good sustainability or safety program. And based on this data, which was done by a scientific survey referenced below, not very good. So let's try this one on for size. Let's say we've got all of these other things. For just a second, we're not even going to talk about safety and sustainability. We're just going to say, what if there are things that affect a positive outcome in an organizational culture? And for this conversation, let's presume that this performance box is actually equal to a healthy culture. Do these things, management values, communication, inclusivity, accountability, and competency, have anything to do with a good, sound, functional organizational culture? Fill in the blank. Safety culture, sustainability culture, DEI culture, quality culture, profitability culture, forward-facing marketing, everything. Do these things, right? These things all exist in a business to some degree or another. Whether they're functional and they're talking to each other is a different matter, but they exist. And when we look at each one into the culture bucket here, we see, look at these extraordinary R-squared values. We're talking about human behavior here. To have R-squares this close to one is ridiculous. Management values, communicating safety and sustainability as a company management, you know, a company value, a core value of your company. If management is making that message known to everybody in the company, that translates to a healthy culture. So in our R-squared idea, right? Management transmitting important values, safety culture, functional. Communication on all levels of the company through all different means, over and over and over, recommunicated, trying until we get it right. When that is high, cultural values are high, and so on around the circuit here. This is huge. And it doesn't matter what is in that center sphere yet. Today we're talking about making it safety and sustainability. So communicate. Matt's probably going to repeat this word again. This is super, super important. George Bernard Shaw said something to the effect of, the problem with communication is people think it happened. We're not into reading minds here, okay? This is not a course on metaphysics. This is, how do we actually translate the management values to the company? How do we go from the bottom and lateral sides up and get information and buy-in for all the processes that are needed? And when we do that, we enable, we include people, and we create opportunities to make those people accountable, which those people is all of us, in ways that are positive and reinforcing and direct us towards an even better culture. And management is still management. We're not turning the whole thing upside down here. But we're saying management has to communicate. I consulted on a brewery about their safety situation, which wasn't really good. But they were a very established brewery. They'd been around for 20 years, a regional. And I saw their mission statement posted on a wall, covered with dust and kind of ragged and a little bit of water damage. And there was no mention of safety in there. None. You haven't even said it. I mean, doing it's another thing, right? That's bigger. But you haven't even transmitted the message that we're of interest. So that's what we're talking about today. And we're going to go from the other end, and we're going to give you some really easy things that you can do, that most of which don't cost a dime, and you can build that safety culture from both directions. So thank you for your indulgence on the culture talk. Now, I'm going to give a definition of safety, my favorite definition, which is safety is freedom from those conditions that cause bad things. And those bad things include death, injury, or occupational illness to our workforce, damage to or loss of equipment. I would add equipment, property, and product. And also processes. We damage processes when we don't have a good culture. And then finally, damage to the environment. I can simplify this whole thing by saying safety is freedom from harm. That's how I like to look at it, right? So safety is a good place. Safety is not a challenge in that it's an obligation. Safety is a value like quality. Sustainability is a value, okay? If you put it in the perspective of safety is a value, it's something we're attaining, right? That's where everybody's talk should begin. And with that, I'm just going to give you a graphic version of my definition of safety, which is safety is protecting the people, protecting your business resources, and protecting the environment. Remember those three icons, and at this point, I'm going to hand it over to my buddy, Matt.
We get to hand off the mic a couple more times, so I love it. The clapping already, though. I love it. Just like Matt did with safety, I'm going to work on defining sustainability, kind of setting a framework here. And the definition I like to use, many sustainability professionals like to use, is from the Brundtland Commission, which is the idea of meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So you'll notice there's nothing in there that says climate change. There's nothing in there that even says environment, right? It's thinking sustainably is about shifting a mindset from just today being important to today and the future? How can we set ourselves and future generations up for success through what we do today? And I highlight this idea of future generations. You know, many of you in the room might have kids or know what kids are. And so maybe that's like where your brain goes when you think future generations. But I also challenge you to think about future generations for your brewery. So, you know, the jobs that you're providing for folks in your community, how are you going to make sure that what you're doing makes your business viable for the long term, for the next generation of folks internally as well as externally, right? You're creating a great product that brings people together, does good work for your community. You know, think of future generations of your beer consumers. As Matt alluded to, we have some similar icons here. And just another, as we were putting this together, it was amazing how many kind of overlaps there were between safety and sustainability. In sustainability, we often talk about the environment, right? And I'm actually, most of my part of this talk is going to be about the environmental side of sustainability. But that's not the whole picture. Especially, you know, in the past year, we're seeing that the social side of sustainability is, there's more discussions happening at the level that they should have been happening for a long time, right? There's the human element of sustainability as well. And then I love to say that it's not sustainable if it's not financially sustainable. You could put in the most state-of-the-art equipment, go way overboard and do everything. But if it puts you out of business, that's not a terribly sustainable solution, is it? You know, you, in order to keep doing good, you need to make sure what you're doing is viable for your business. Okay, so there's the kind of the framework setting portion of the presentation. Now, this is a slide that Matt put together because it's a tongue twister. So SASU on a shoestring is what we're talking about now. And these are some helpful checklists. And I'll mention kind of before diving into it, you'll notice that we don't have bullet points for these checklists. We have literal boxes. When you have access to this presentation, feel free to print it out, keep a digital copy, and literally use it however you see fit. Literally as a checklist. So the way we're going to organize this is some sustainability suggestions for both breweries as well as tap rooms, and then Matt will come back up for to do safety for the same. Before I start getting into any of this of what's on the slide, there's kind of an overarching piece of this that is relevant for both safety and sustainability, and that's the old adage that you can't manage what you don't measure. So, you know, we could have put that on every single slide here, but definitely one of the ways to make sure that you are moving in the right direction, that you even know where there are problems, is to measure and move forward from there. So I'm going to start with energy, and the first one seems devastatingly obvious, but is real. It's shutting off equipment when not in use. And you might say, hey, of course we do that. But I challenge you to actually audit your processes and your facilities and see if that is the case. You know, if you've got a packaging line, are conveyor belts running while your team's on lunch? Where are there opportunities that you can just shut off where there's when you're not using it? Similarly, on lights, light sensors are a cheap solution. Turning off lights even cheaper. And I include this bullet point with a huge asterisk that this is a safety presentation as well. And so, of course, make sure that you have adequate lighting to have a safe work environment. But if there are spaces that are not being used at all for hours in the day, think if there's opportunities there to cut out some electricity usage. Certainly maintenance planning. I can't think of any exceptions to the rule that not properly maintained equipment is less efficient. So yeah, for filters, insulation, exhaust fans, all of that, make sure that maintenance planning is part of your culture, that this is a normalized thing, that we have it on a schedule and that we're looking at the equipment. Doesn't cost anything but time and can have a huge impact. And then checking the compressed air system for leaks. This is a huge electricity user in a brewery. And if you do have leaks, then you are, you know, wasting that compressed air as well as all of the electrons that went into pressurizing it. Similarly, on the water side, so in sustainability in breweries, we talk about water a lot. It's something that you see. You watch it go down the drain. And so with that in mind, definitely build in leak detection processes if that's one person on a schedule, if it's everyone, right? Like Matt was talking about with an inclusive culture for all of these, make everyone responsible that if they see something leaking, that it's at least risen to someone who can help address it. Recapturing clean process water for reuse, right? There's a lot of examples of this. Some from the water for the water scarce West out here. There's a brewery that is, you know, for their pre-rinse of bottles on their packaging line, they'll recapture that and then use it actually for a final rinse after the bottle's filled. Same with a CIP system. If you're doing hot water sanitization at the end of your CIP, if there's an opportunity to capture that water for an earlier stage cleanse on a subsequent batch. Sidestream yeast slurry. Certainly, wastewater is a huge topic of conversation for all different reasons, and a lot of breweries find that there is a cost associated with side streaming, of course. It's storage, it's hauling. But a lot of times that is actually cheaper than paying the additional fines from your municipal wastewater system for ultra-high strength wastewater. And then analyzing your CIP. You'll notice a lot of these bullet points really have to do with looking and being mindful and really assessing your processes. Including for your CIP. Is there a step that can be cut a little bit shorter? Maybe not, you know, but look at it. And if you are able to save a few minutes on a particular step every batch, that adds up over the course of a year and years. So then on the solid waste side, I would imagine most, if not all of you, are diverting your spent grains from the landfill in one way or the other, but just wanted to include this bullet that there are additional creative ways working with bakers. You know, I was just reading an article about a granola maker in Virginia Beach that's working with breweries to get their spent grain for his product, and it ends up being more of kind of a circular economy there. And then opportunities to compost on site. Reusing yeast when possible. Again, this is something that, you know, might not be something that is that you do a lot of, but if you even do a little bit, if you find the opportunity to reuse a little bit here and there, that adds up. In terms of creative solutions for hard to recycle items, there have been a bunch of great talks actually at CBC through the BA about recycling co-ops and different programs that have been built up that have breweries that don't have, they're not producing the amount of hard to recycle waste that is a quantity that a recycler would actually be buying back that material from on their own. And so they'll work with other local breweries, other local manufacturers, and build up that co-op, and that turns what would be either going to the landfill most likely going to the landfill and a cost to actually become an opportunity for revenue and diversion from the landfill. And then on the glass recycling side, just a quick note that over the last 5 to 10 years, China, which had been accepting most of the glass from the US that was recycled and then actually repurposing it, has shifted away from that strategy. And so a lot of glass is actually being used mostly as landfill cover or just thrown into the landfill. So One thing I would say is reach out to your local recycler. Make sure that the glass is being put back into new products, as well as seeing if there is a specific glass recycler. On the input side, again, checking for leaks, sourcing locally whenever possible. This isn't going to be applicable for everyone everywhere, but what could be closer? What could you source closer? Cut down on transportation emissions. And then the final bullet point. I understand that most of the folks in this room are with breweries that aren't gargantuan and don't have the buyer power to tell their suppliers, you must change this or else, right? But what you do have the ability to do is do the research and see, is there another supplier, similar quality, similar price point, that has better practices, and you could vote with your dollars that way. All right, moving on to the tap room. So again, kicking off with that kind of phantom load idea of equipment that's not in use, turning it off and unplugging it. Now, when we're talking about replacing lights with LED, I'm not asking you to go out to Home Depot, get 200 LEDs, and unscrew all of your fully functioning light bulbs right now, but build it into your process that as your CFL or your incandescents burn out and are no longer useful, then replace with LEDs, and you'll see that incremental additional cost really doesn't hurt nearly as bad as a one-time purchase all over, and LED is much better for the environment when it's disposed of than a CFL, and just saves a ton more electricity than an incandescent. Better sealing your walk-ins, as well as the next bullet point, which is keeping heat sources physically away from refrigeration, right? Like this one, a lot of people are working with a small area. There might not be too much space to move things around, but just think about kind of like the thermal competition that's happening if you have refrigeration right next to a heating element, and understanding that you can make both more efficient if there is some physical separation. Running fully loaded washers, that will save both on electricity and water. And then the idea, again, for replacing your tech with Energy Star. If you have a TV in your tap room, if it's fully functional, don't just throw it in the landfill. The overall footprint of doing that compared to in getting an Energy Star is actually worse. So just wait until those items are at the end of their useful life. Recycle your TV, and then get an Energy Star the next time around. So for water and wastewater, adding aerators to faucets and high-efficiency spray valves, these are small budget items that can have a big impact. The dual-flush toilets is an interesting one because that's starting to get some engagement with your customers as well, and get them have them have some agency in this whole sustainability story. They get to decide how much is being used, and you get to demonstrate that this is something that we're all working on together. Again, worn spray valves for on the maintenance side, and then track your ice usage. If you do have an ice machine, you could end up wasting a lot of water if at the end of service you've got a fully full ice machine that's just going to melt overnight and start again in the morning. So trying to track and get that as low as possible by the end of service. On the solid waste side, so buying in bulk whenever possible, then tracking usage, similar to the ice, track your food usage to cut down on food waste. If you're serving food and you're seeing plates come back with French fries on them, this is a terrible example. Plates never come back with French fries on them. But if it's something similar, the kale that you have, if you're seeing that, try to figure out where you can cut down on that food waste. Reducing contamination in the waste baskets. I mentioned both front of house and back of house because you could have great signage. Employees really engaged with your customers front of house and have people separating where they need to. But if back of house, everyone's throwing everything into one bin, that's going to contaminate your waste stream, and it will make the kind of further down in the waste disposal process much less efficient. So make sure that you're engaging both front of house and back of house, and this really is a big cultural piece. And then finally, on this side is minimizing single-use anything. I know that there are limitations, and there are some tap rooms where compostable flatware is what's used. And just know as part of your process that the overall environmental footprint of a compostable spoon is always going to be more than a metal spoon that's used thousands and thousands of times. That's just washed. So keep that in mind and try to minimize single-use anything. And then finally, on the input side, balance your draft system, saving both beer and CO2, as well as sourcing locally. There's an example of a brewery out in California that's buying produce from a local farm. Their food scraps go back to that farm for compost, and then it kind of closes that loop in a very close area. So it's not just cutting down on transportation emissions, but is actually putting outputs from one system as an input into another and back around, which is great environmentally and an amazing partner locally in the community. And with that, I'll hand on over to Matt for safety.
Thanks, Matt. Lots of great ideas there. So I'll do the same thing, starting with production facilities first. And what I'd like to outline first are what we call systemic conditions. So these don't relate to a particular process. They're facility-wide. And one of the most important things you can do is maintain good housekeeping. Yes, there are the obvious safety benefits of not tripping over piles of clutter, but there's a more nuanced effect of good housekeeping, and that is it creates this sort of clean palette, a blank canvas in your workplace, where you can identify things that need to be changed. You can see things, right? You can think clearly. You're not also trying to negotiate issues of just trying to get from point A to point B. Stowing hoses is a good example, right? Oh, I'm going to need those again in a half an hour. Well, at very least, get them out of the aisle. Just work on little things like that. They don't cost anything. Matt snuck in the word normalize in what he said, and I want to double down on that. When we talk about normalization, it can be good normalization or bad normalization. It's a behavior. And that is, a bad normalization would be, oh, I'm going to use the hoses again, so I just leave them right where they are, and they're right in the middle, and I just have to walk over them. And yes, somewhere back in the recesses of my mind, I know that's unsafe. But I do it anyways, and I keep doing it, and I try to pay attention to where the hoses are. And so far, I haven't broken my ankle or fallen in a puddle of caustic. So it's working for me so far. But the future is not directly correlated to past events in terms of safety. So, that's a normalization. Normalization is I wear my safety glasses on the top of my head. Okay, when things come flying at you, it is unexpected. That's why you wear safety glasses all the time, okay, in certain activities. That's why you should be wearing those. So you can normalize a good behavior or you can normalize an unsafe behavior. It's up to you. But if you have good communication in your safety culture, you identify that amongst each other. Hey, boss, you're in the packaging line. We always wear safety glasses here. I'll get you a pair. Boom. Beautiful. Vertical to, lateral vertical communication going on right there. It's solution-oriented. It's positive communication, that kind of stuff, right? If my favorite proverb of all time is the fish rots from the head. So if, management isn't transmitting values of things like let's keep the place orderly here, you need that message. So and because walking and working surfaces are everywhere in a production area, keeping those free from slip hazards and trip hazards is very important. Emergency planning, I'm not going to go through all these things, but there are so many things that we can plan for, and we hope they never happen. And if we plan for them and they never happen, that's awesome. If we plan for them and they happen and we react pretty well, also awesome. If we don't plan for them and it happens, we have a cascade of problems because we're reacting on the moment to things that we should have predicted could have happened. Okay, bad outcome there. So planning is really helpful. And in addition to planning, I'm going to plug right now conducting practice runs or a drill on things. You'll hear about that more in a bit. Another systemic issue that is plant-wide is what is our personal protective equipment policy for different parts of the operation? What are the clothing requirements? Okay, if you are all wearing pants in the production area, thank you very much. Down with shorts. If you're all wearing pants in the production area, and the boss comes in wearing his Tevas and the shorts and a Bermuda shirt and no safety glasses, that just disenfranchises everybody in your safety program. So it's one for all and all for one, and PPE is definitely there. PPE is there for things that you're not expecting to happen when it may not be expected to happen. So you have to be wearing it for it to work. And it's the last line of defense in the safety person's, giant arsenal of tools. Personal protective equipment fails, you get exposed. The end, right? It's the last line of defense. It's an important line of defense, but there's nothing else after that. So use it, please. It's inexpensive. It's effective. And finally, in the brewery environment, noise is a big one. When the hearing standard came out from OSHA, earbuds weren't even invented. So here's somebody working in a packaging line where it's very noisy, a lot of clanking going on, or near a centrifuge, and the ambient noise is already getting close to where a hearing program should be in place. And then in order to hear their music, they either turn up the Megadeth real loud on the house stereo, or they put their earbuds in on 11. And we don't even know how to measure what the eardrum is actually receiving in that setting, right? The noise of a centrifuge and Megadeth at 11. So you have to say, look, Megadeth later, while we're doing cleanup, but right now, while we're running equipment, we need to hear bearings, we need to hear pump cavitation, we need to hear a scream for help. They call me the safety ambassador because ambassador because I say things like, you got to grow up sometimes, okay? And this is a free, this falls into today's topic. It's free. Okay. Now, situational hazards relate to a specific activity, and the two that I want to really point out here are kettle boilovers and dry hop, pick your word, volcano popcorning geyser. Both of these really come back to people are trying to brew more volume per run than their system was designed for. Did I say grow up? Please, if it's a 20-barrel system, don't knock out 24 barrels. You're asking for really serious, serious outcomes. People die with a boil over, okay? And tanks explode when pressure relief valves are gunked up because you filled that fermenter too full. And if you're going to fill the fermenter too full, by golly, take that PRV off between every batch and do a nice cleaning on it. Again, it's free. How do you recognize that? You involve people on the production floor, and the boss comes in and says, why aren't we making beer? Well, because we had to do this thing because the thing was all gunked up. Well, why was the thing gunked up, right? And follow it back and work together to come up with a better method. And then document that method because you have to write this stuff down. And finally, one of the best tools for inclusivity is to have some sort of a group of people that represent the whole company. We use the word safety team or safety committee commonly. And that they get together and they do stuff. And they involve people. And that stuff is mostly two things. They look at tasks and they say, what could hurt us when we perform this task? And then come up with solutions to reduce the harm. And then they say, and now let's institutionalize that as SOPs so that we can go forward consistently. SOPs save time, they save money, they improve quality, they reduce injuries, they are a training aid, and they're also CYA if OSHA comes knocking. Okay, so in the brewpub side, everything I just said for production goes for a production side of the brewpub, so I'm going to focus a little bit more on front of house and kitchen sort of thing. Again, housekeeping is huge. and emergency planning again, but now you've got the added emergency of what do we do with people who are not our employees, right? Okay, you live in the, you know, you live in the tornado belt. Would it be a good idea to someday stop and say, hey, what should we do if we have a tornado and we have customers here? Do we all shelter in place? Do we tell everybody to leave and close the doors? Do we send them to the YMCA that's next door? You know, what do? Make a plan and then practice it once. And then the systemic condition that I see a lot of in front of house, I mean, I see it everywhere, but I'm glad we're talking about it these days, what we call psychosocial hazards. So we have chemical hazards, physical hazards, ergonomic hazards, biological hazards, and psychosocial stuff. That's the stuff where people are involved in the cause and receiving of dangerous things. And they can be within us, like stress and anxiety, or from overwork, we can be fatigued. It can be a toxic workplace situation. It can be we don't have a substance policy for shifty beers. Or beers, you know, any, you know, what's our policy here? You know, I'm not here to tell you what that policy is. That's part of your culture to decide what that policy is. But get everybody involved that needs to be involved and come up with a plan and then try it. And if it doesn't work, you can tweak it. And then providing PPE, right? You can't have a PPE program if you're not providing the stuff. And if the stuff is always depleted, either refill it or, better yet, say, why is it being depleted? You know, are we just not providing enough, or are people taking it home so they can do their turducken on the weekend? You know, who knows what? Situational hazards here front of house. A biological hazard is one. I'll give you a quick example. I was training a group of front of house staff, and I said, you know what to do in case we encounter somebody's body fluids? And they're like, what are you talking? And I said, well, you could have an injury. One of you could cut your hands in the sink on a piece of broken glass. We could have a customer that something didn't set right with them and they lost it, their cookies in the bathroom, right? We could have some people in the hot tub, in the mash tun that thought it was a hot tub, and who knows what happened over there, okay? So, and thankfully, we have good sanitizers in the brewery. But at any rate, so what I did is I went into the bathroom and I took some chicken soup and I threw it on the floor. And then I said, okay, now we've got a biological hazard in the bathroom. Let's practice cleaning it up. And that involved personal protection. It involved bleach, disinfection. It involved having the right dustpan and brush and a waste container for waste management. And we went through it together. And now they really know how to do it, because you don't want your first experience with that to be the real stuff, right? I mean, it's bad enough. At least know you have to do it and how to do it and get it right. And I'm sorry I ruined chicken soup for some of you. And then finally, training. You've got to have some orientation that includes safety as a conversation and tells people how they now interface into the rest of the safety culture for the company so that they can participate and benefit from it. So back to Matt here. He's going to bring us to a close.
Thanks, Matt. So I'm going to try to take us across the finish line with a couple more resources for you before we head to questions. Just a reminder, please do throw your questions up on Slido. We're in Mile High City Ballroom 2 and 3, so you're submitting to the right room. All right, so kicking off with resources, the Brewers Association has an incredible wealth of resources. If you go to the homepage, up on the top right, there's a resource hub. Within the resource hub, there's sections for both safety and sustainability, as well as a number of other areas. All of these different resources that you see here, I'll mention from the sustainability side, we have a benchmarking tool that is really, really good for tracking your usage over time, see how you're doing against yourself, as well as breweries of similar sizes to you in terms of normalized energy use or water use, etc. And then from the safety side, there's some really amazing guidance manuals and one-pagers on particular topics. So please do check this out. Additionally, the BA isn't the only game in town, and there's a lot of amazing resources that exist from these other industry groups, both within safety and sustainability. When you get this presentation, these are all linked, so it'll take you right there, make it easy for you, but a lot of great resources out there, too. And then government resources. So on the sustainability side, there are a number of rebates, incentives from your local utility, municipal government, state government, and federal government, as well as some other programs that exist. Like in the second bullet there is the Small Business Environmental Assistance Program, where there are people dedicated from the state level to support your small business on the environment. And then for safety, definitely check out lots of amazing stuff from OSHA, from NIOSH, and CDC. All right, so just to put a bow on it, because the first bullet point is communication, we're going to over-communicate. So the success drivers for a culture of safety and sustainability in your brewery, communication, not just at orientation, though that's important, but also management skills documentation throughout. Communicate, then communicate again, then do it one more time, and then do it one more time. It's so valuable, and it helps kind of build that important culture. If you remember from the R-squared values that Matt sent, this communication was the highest of these many high correlations. Next, management values. Make sure that these are exemplified, reinforced, and consistent, though understanding that you have to learn every day, so make it adaptive. And an important piece on this is if you are a manager, understand where your employees feel you're at on all of these as well. If you're sitting and you feel really good about all five of these drivers, make sure that you're asking some of your employees anonymously and see if that tracks as well. Accountability from the monitoring, tracking, and analysis side. Inclusivity, we've mentioned this a few times, so important to bring in different voices from different departments, different tenure at the company, different demographics. Make sure that you have the perspective and the strength of those numbers for an inclusive approach. And then certainly last but definitely not least is the competency piece, the training and the equipment to make sure that's ongoing. You have these great low-cost/no-cost checklists that are, again, part of this presentation, the free resources that I mentioned, and then finally, come meet us. We'll be around after this talk for sure. We'll answer some questions now, but we'll also be upstairs at the BA booth today and tomorrow. We can only tell each other so many bad jokes before we disintegrate, so please come save us from ourselves and come say hi.
Please.
And so we'll put it there and say thank you. And I believe the questions are going to pop up.
I think if you go one more, Matt.
One more. Check that out. Okay. So it looks like we'll just kind of run through these and see. So does the Food Safety Modernization Act allow spent grains to still be sent out for use in human foods? So on this one, as well as animal feed. So on this one, FSMA is working on a lot of stuff in terms of like storage practices and labeling and making sure there's no contamination. But I believe it's still possible just with a couple more hoops to jump through to make sure that it can be used for human food.
Thanks, Matt. I'll take the next one. Do we have tips for enforcing safety processes without being seen as aggressive or nagging? Yes. Well, first of all, in a functional, healthy safety culture, everybody is involved in understanding and developing what those policies are going to be. And then management reinforces that message and supplies the resources necessary to make sure that all the PPE is there. That's the first part. The second part is reminding all employees that they have an OSHA obligation to be safe, follow establish procedures, regulations, and use equipment provided. This comes from OSHA's foundation in 1970, something called the General Duty Clause, which says the employer has the responsibility to create a safe workplace, and employees have the obligation to do as they're told, use equipment as needed, and adhere to safety regulation. So if you don't have good communication, you can't get that message across. I don't buy into the he said, she said of safety. It's management's, you know, the employees aren't wearing their PPE. Well, management isn't getting us PPE, right? No, it's a collective, and the legal responsibility is both of those parties. So, and then thirdly, I would say if that messaging doesn't get across, then it is, this is the way we do it. And one of the common responses to that is, but we never have before. And you say, that's correct. But beginning today, this is how we do it. And tomorrow, it might be different. But today, it is this. Today, we all wear safety glasses whenever we're in the packaging line. Okay? We all wear our pant legs over our boots when we're on the brew deck. When there's steam running, we have a brewer on the deck. Whatever it is, this is what it is going forward. Today, there was an old cereal ad that said, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Okay? There's nothing in anybody's employment deal that says, I agreed to not wear PPE. Okay? So point it out that it's everybody's responsibility, and most people will get on board with that. And the sticks that get stuck in the mud, you have to make an HR decision about that, ultimately. Or they'll leave because it's awkward for them because they're the one that doesn't work. Okay.
Great. I'll jump to the next one from Taylor. What's an easy sustainability win that you see most often overlooked? This one, for me, it's asking your staff what could be better, right? These are, I could say, you know, do one particular thing, but that's not going to apply to all of you. What could apply to everyone is ask your staff where water is being wasted, where electricity is being wasted, where there is, you're having, you know, too much, you know, solid waste issues, anything like that. These are the folks that are hands-on, can let you know if there are leaks, if there is equipment that's not properly maintained, if there's, you know, any number of things. So I think that's a big win in addition to kind of building that inclusive culture in sustainability where it's not just you as the owner or, you know, you as management's duty to make sure the brewery is more sustainable, but bring in more voices. Super easy win. It takes the amount of time of a question in a staff meeting or you know, having people think about it and submit any ideas. But that is a super easy win that can have some big implications. Some examples of ways to sidestream your ooh, I lost it. Okay. About sidestreaming. You know, there's a lot of the solutions involve an additional tank, right? So a storage tank for side streaming after you transfer your beer, and that could be hauled away pumped from an outside vendor. Again, that is not the cheapest of the shoestring suggestions, but I challenge you to look at it holistically and see what you're paying for. High-strength wastewater fees, and see if it might make sense to do that. Is this PowerPoint presentation available, Matt?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, that's a very common question. After the fact here, this will be posted on the Brewers Association website, and then go to the landing page and hit Resource Hub. That's the little colored wheel Matt showed you earlier. And then you will find this presentation under both sustainability and safety. And you can download the checklist from there.
All right. Any comments on using next generation to reduce CO2 consumption? I don't have many comments on that right now. I will say, you know, reducing CO2 consumption is a big topic of conversation right now. There's a lot of sort of creative solutions, including, I know right here in Denver, there's capturing of CO2 to be sent to a cannabis grow facility. There's a lot of new solutions out about CO2 capture as well as reduction. I'm happy to take that one and put together some resources when we publish this after.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. Matt. I think we'll probably even roll in a couple of our engineering colleagues on that question too, mm-hmm. because this is a broad question that touches on a lot of bases.
Yeah.
Next one, can OSHA fine individual employees for being willfully non-compliant? No, they fine the employer. So employer, get your HR game in order and deal with that employee. End.
Perfect. Looks like one popped to the
top. Okay, what are some common brewery back-of-house failures from OSHA inspections? The number one is not having a hazard communication program. That is, your SDSs are up to date, your chemical containers are properly labeled and stored, you have personal protective equipment, and your staff are trained to use it and use the proper equipment in handling chemicals. That's number one. Lockout, tagout's a big one, forklift. If you're not certified, buy a certified trainer and hold a 3-year certificate. Do not get on the forklift even for a second, and you must be 18 years old. Documentation of forklift is, there. People are getting popped on that one all the time. But don't do it because OSHA says so. Do it because you have to go through the course to learn some really cool stuff about forklifts, about this thing called the stability triangle, which has to do with momentum and inertia and the center of gravity of the piece of equipment when it's under load. And once you have that, boy, you'll drive a forklift differently.
I guess it probably
goes for both of us, Matt, on maintenance calendar.
Yeah, I'll start it off. Build it into your processes, right? When you're, there are a number of different activities that you're probably doing on weekly and monthly basis. Hopefully already. If not, make it. Part in your calendar, part of the task for your crew, that understanding the equipment needs. So not everything is going to need to be checked every week, but understanding that having sort of a set schedule, first Tuesday of every month or whatever, can go a long way, and it just becomes normalized, and that's part of your first Tuesday of every month activities.
That's right, and I would add to that. For things like pressure relief valves and GFCIs and so forth, build in the check into doing the job. So we're turning over this fermenter for the, getting ready to receive wort for the next batch, and we do this, 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 and this, and taking off the PRV and inspecting it is part of that, for example. So as Matt said quite rightly, the schedule for different types of inspections varies. Some of it's preventative, check your fire extinguishers once every 6 months. There's a pressure dial indicating it's in the good spot. Okay, you're fine. End of story. Eye washes, you decide what the schedule is. GFCI, bet you didn't know this one. I just learned it myself the other day. Every time you use a GFCI outlet and put an appliance into it, you should test the circuit with the test button every time. Did you know that? Pretty cool. Okay, are there CIP skid options for small brew pubs? Not that I know of. I mean, the smaller systems a small CIP system can be a bucket and a recirculating pump and some hoses. It's whatever you make it. And I just want to add a comment I haven't made yet today, which is OSHA is very open to any sort of solution that you come up with if it reduces hazard, right? OSHA is not as prescriptive as you might imagine, okay? They say create a safe and healthful workplace. They don't always tell you how to do that. So when you create a process, and here's a quick example. A friend of mine has a small brewery, and his mill is in the basement. And they have to take a separate door. They come down through a bulkhead into the basement to where the mill is, and then, I knock on the ceiling with a broom handle. Here it comes, right? and they were creating dust down there, and the guy's got this epic beard. And the dust would get in the beard, and then the malt dust was irritating him, and he couldn't get good coverage with a dust mask because of the beard. And so they get a shop vac and a piece of dryer duct, and they make a local exhaust vent right over the hopper, so when they're dumping sacks of grain in, and there's some kickback from the mill, it gets sucked into the vacuum cleaner. Now, if that is sound from a standpoint of not causing a dust explosion, which it wouldn't under, you know, I've actually seen the setup, then that's a fabulous solution. You can MacGyver all day long. And doing the same thing with boil over prevention on a kettle that doesn't have one. You know, you can add that stuff. Somebody said the other day, you know, you can change your equipment? Oh, yeah. You can definitely change it. You can make it better. Take a look on the floor up there, and you look at the breweries that are on the floor, and you look for a boil-over sensor in their kettles. You call me if you find one. I want to know who that is. It should be standard equipment, okay? But it's not, because we haven't made it a demand. 25 years ago, when you bought a fermenter, a pressure relief valve was optional. You had to pay extra for it. Imagine. Who was going to pay those extra couple $100? We're starting a brewery. We're broke, you know? No, it needs to be standard equipment. Yes, the question is there a certification required for walk-behind forklifts? No, there is not, but you need to undertake some good training and have a policy and do good maintenance on it. Good question.
Cool. And I know we're right about at time here, and so I really appreciate Anonymous for teeing this up as a closing remark. But in terms of typical wastewater volume by brewery capacity, I encourage everyone here to download the benchmarking tool from the BA Resource Hub, which has, I don't want to answer this question because it varies a lot by size of brewery, and the benchmarking tool is broken down by those sizes. So definitely check that out if you want to see how you're doing compared to other similarly sized breweries. And with that, we'll say thank you so much for sticking with us and enjoy the rest of CBC.
Thank you.